Hi everyone, it's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today I'm visiting Benchmark, one of the world's most renowned venture capital firms, in the heart of Tenderloin in San Francisco, to chat with two of its general partners, Sarah Tavel and Eric Vishria. Sarah has a unique background as an investor, then operator, then back to investor. In the mid-2000s, she joined Silicon Valley-based Bessemer, where she led investments in Pinterest and others. She went on to join Pinterest back when there were only a few dozen people, before returning back to venture 3.5 years later. She's now a GP at Benchmark and on the board of HipCamp and Chainalysis. Eric started his career as an operator working in Opsware and HP before founding RockMelt, a social take on the web browser back in 2008. Later, the company was acquired by Yahoo, where Eric joined as a VP before making the leap into venture at Benchmark. Over the past 4 years, he's led investments in Confluent, Contentful, Amplitude, and others. On the podcast, we chat about what it's like to go from operating to investing and why patience is so important, why Sarah is playing Fortnite for research purposes, she says, and we discuss the next big opportunity in social. But before we jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Do you remember a time when you started working for yourself? It was certainly no small feat, and you've been insanely busy ever since. Our friends at FreshBooks are here to make things easier for freelancers like you. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed to save you time and all those terrible administrative tasks. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and get paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. Also, file expenses with ease to keep them perfectly organized for that lovely tax time. Go to freshbooks.com/producthunt and enter Product Hunt Radio in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. In addition to my day job at Product Hunt, I also invest in early stage startups through a fund I started. I called it Weekend Fund. At first, I was hesitant to invest in startups, worried that my time would get sucked away into back office management, LP tax reporting, and all the overhead that goes into managing a fund. Fortunately, AngelList Venture Services handle all that for me, so I can focus on finding and backing great entrepreneurs. So far, AngelList has hosted over 130 venture funds, ranging from $500,000 to several millions of dollars under management. The team is super knowledgeable, having supported hundreds of investors over the years, and eager to help fund managers plan a fundraising strategy. Once you've raised capital from LPs, you choose what startups to back, and AngelList handles the rest. If you're interested in investing in startups, take a look at angel.co/venturefunds, or email me at ryan@producthunt.com, and I'd be happy to help. Hey everybody, this is Ryan Hoover. I'm at Benchmark here in San Francisco with Sarah and Eric. How's it going?
Great.
Hey, good to see you.
Thanks for having me. You have an amazing view. We're in the corner of the office here.
Yeah, on Market Street.
On beautiful Sixth. Market Street.
In the middle of the Tenderloin.
Yeah.
I actually used to live 2 or 3 blocks away, right over there.
Oh man.
Yeah, so I walk through the Tenderloin and Sixth Street quite often.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I love the location and the building, but sometimes it can get a little uncomfortable outside.
A little dicey.
Yeah.
But Sarah, do you want to tell us about your background? What are you working on? Where are you from?
I'm a native New Yorker, so I grew up in Manhattan. Moved to Silicon Valley or San Francisco in 2011 at another venture firm called Bessemer. Very quickly, I was at a venture firm called Bessemer, where I'd been for a few years, and then ended up joining Pinterest pretty early on as one of the, I guess, really one of the first product managers, if not the first, after having invested in the company, and was there for almost 3.5 years before coming back to the venture side at Greylock.
How many people were at Pinterest when you joined?
It was a couple dozen, probably a little like 25 or so. And then went to be one of the GPs at Greylock. I was on the consumer team there, and then got to know the Benchmark team and realized how different it was, and ended up making the decision to join Benchmark as the one of the GPs here. And so have been here for, I guess, 1.5 years and spend a lot of time in consumer and crypto and some software as a service stuff.
Nice. And Eric, what's your background? What'd you do before coming here to Benchmark?
Well, I was a founder before I came here. I spent most of my career as an operator. So I actually grew up in Tennessee, just outside of Memphis, and came out to the Valley for school and stayed. So I, like a lot of other people, I joined in January of 2000. I joined Ben Horowitz and Mark Andreessen at LoudCloud as Ben's assistant, and spent 8.5 years through the ups and downs of LoudCloud becoming Opsware and then ultimately getting bought by HP. And then I started a company with one of the other co-founders of LoudCloud, Tim Howes, called RockMelt, and went through the ups and downs as an entrepreneur and CEO for 4.5 years, and then got bought by Yahoo and spent a year at Yahoo. And then I switched to the investing side and have been at Benchmark for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So you both went from, you know, working on as operators and companies into VC. How did you, a lot of people have asked me actually, because I'm doing some investing, but I'm full-time job is product hunt. Some people have asked me like what it's like to invest, but I've never done it full-time like you have, or even at the scale or stage that you have. How do you adjust? Do you miss building?
I personally do not miss building at all. Being an entrepreneur is very hard, and operating is very hard. And I think you have to have an irrational desire and passion for, one, doing it, and two, the problem you're working on. So I actually think it's very challenging. If you don't do it, you shouldn't do that. Like it's the odds are stacked against you. It's hard. And it's really hard. And it can also be enormously rewarding. The way I describe it is, for me, investing, the highs are less high and the lows are less low. So it's kind of a more muted and moderated experience. Some of the stuff around talent identification, recruiting, thinking about like the next big idea, like a lot of those things are consistent, but so much of operating is figuring out how to get stuff done, actually hiring the right people, motivating them, aligning people, breaking ties, those types of things. Whereas most of venture capital, at least the way we practice it, which is very small number of investments per person per year, very serious engagement with those companies. As a firm, we'll make something like 8 investments a year. So the way we practice it with that level of focus at the early stages, it's really about looking at a lot of stuff, falling in love with an opportunity and an entrepreneur, and deeply engaging. And so whereas operating is mostly figuring out how to get stuff done and very little of figuring out what to do. And in a lot of ways, venture is like 90% or 95% figuring out what to do and like 5% getting it done.
Yeah. It's such a kind of intellectual role, in the sense that you have the time, and your job is to basically look at the space, talk to the people who are building like the next big thing. And that's what's pretty exciting about investing.
If you love to learn, I just don't think there's a better job, because it's exactly what you said, that you're constantly ramping up on new things. I mean, over the holidays, I was, you know, ramping up on trying to understand, you know, what's happening in the gaming world. And, you know, I joked with my wife that I had to play Fortnite, honey. It's, you know, for my job, you know, and like, but there's, you know, you get to speak to interesting people all the time. It's, you're constantly just learning about new areas, digging in. And I just feel so lucky to have this job. At the same time, there are definitely things that you can't help but miss about operating. I mean, to Eric's point, like, I kind of think about operating as like you're building something. Like, imagine you're putting bricks down and putting the plumbing in. And then every day you get to see the work that you've done, and you get to feel how things are improving, or you're making progress like along a certain goal. But then when you switch to venture, it's this process of planting seeds you plant seeds, and every day you're planting new seeds, and then you kind of look and it's still like this barren, you know, dirt, like, and then it takes a while for things to start to sprout. And so you have this kind of very different frame of mind that you have to adjust to, that you have to set into, which is, you know, you have to step away from being used to getting stuff done and doing it yourself, and more kind of trusting the inputs that you're doing, and just trusting that that's going to end up resulting in something that is great. It's a very big adjustment. I have, you know, I was lucky that I had venture experience and then operating, and I went to venture back again. And so I had that prior experience, but I thought it was going to be like getting on a bike again, and ended up being more like getting a train back on the tracks. Like, it was much more intentional than I thought it would be. And I was lucky enough to have that experience beforehand, but someone coming with no venture experience and a career of operating, that's got to be a pretty big adjustment.
Yeah, it requires patience.
Yes,
I think.
It really does. And people talk about the feedback cycles, but you can't talk about that enough. You know, like at Pinterest, we would launch an experiment and then in a week we would know whether there was statistically significant data showing that our hypothesis was right. In venture, there are so many instances where you even have a company that you think is not working and, you know, a Discord or a Docker, and it ends up becoming these huge successes after a pivot. And so it just, there's nothing that's predictable in a way.
Yeah, my relatively limited experience is it's kind of frustrating in the sense that you can't move things faster. It's not your job, and nor can you as like an investor make things go faster. It's not your job, and you just have to plant those seeds and then support and hope that it becomes something.
Totally.
Yeah. So Benchmark is obviously super well known in the Valley. It's been around how long? 21 years. I don't know. How has it been different maybe from Greylock or other firms that you've participated in? Bessemer, of course, as well.
Well, I think it's been an interesting evolution because Benchmark from the very beginning has taken almost you could think of as a contrarian stance in the market, which is that from the very beginning, the founders set Benchmark up to be this equal partnership. So everybody who joins Benchmark is a general partner. There's no junior partners or senior partners or levels of people, that aren't partners themselves, associates, et cetera. There's no talent partners or marketing partners. We believed from the very beginning that the job was something that couldn't be delegated, that we had to have that very close relationship with the founder, that we would be early investors. We're really Series A investors. We do some Series B, but we're often the first check in a company, which is something that I think people don't know a lot about Benchmark. But that structure of, really equality at a partnership level is something that is just very unique. And, and it's in some ways the Valley has gone in completely the other extreme direction. It's incredible to see how big many of the other venture firms are getting, and not just from a fund perspective, but from a people perspective. Growing, it's almost like they're vertically integrating. They've got seed investing, early stage investing, growth investing. Some even have, public equity investing, debt, as part of their platform. They've got talent teams and marketing teams and customer development teams. And we've just decided to stay very, very focused on what we do, which is being a close partner at that Series A and being the people we hope at the board that shepherd the company from that early stages to unlocking their ambition and becoming one of those iconic companies. And, some of the early stage companies that we've done that with are companies like, Confluent, which was actually Eric's first investment, Discord, which was a pivot, interestingly, an investment by Mitch Lasky, Nextdoor, which was actually another pivot, an investment that Bill Gurley did. I mentioned Chainalysis, there's HackerOne. I mean, there's a long list of these companies, and it's all the same thing, which is us being the earliest investor, just being that close partner to the entrepreneur.
And you do each individual partner does how many deals a year?
It's a good question because the strength of our approach is that we form very tight ties with the companies we work with because we're very involved. The corresponding weakness, you could say, is that we have no leverage in our system. There isn't anybody to whom we can, delegate some of the work. And so it ends up meaning that we make fewer investments per partner per year than many other firms. And so I'd say that on average, we probably invest in, a company and a half per year per partner. And so we've got, five active general partners now at Benchmark. And so you can do the math there.
I feel it's kind of like the older I get, the fewer friends I feel like I need. And what I mean by that is it's sort of like you're finding your best friends or something. And all you need is 5 to 10 really good friends, I think, around you in life.
It's really true. The way I describe what a really great board member should do for the company is almost like what a really great partner for you. Like when you find the person that you should marry and hopefully do marry, they make you the best version of themselves. Peter, my partner, he describes it as this sublime relationship that happens. And I think that the best board members do that too, which is that they help an entrepreneur be the best version of themselves as the CEO of the company and therefore help shepherd the company to its, you know, its full potential. And you, in order to be that for a company, you have to be involved because you have to have fully internalize the challenges that the founder and the company are going through. You have to be working with them shoulder to shoulder on the big hires that they need to make or the strategic decisions that they have to make. And I think that many people haven't ever experienced what great can feel like, what that sublime board relationship can feel like. And so they almost have lower expectations of what a great board member should be than what I really think, at least we all around the table aspire to.
Yeah. What are you looking at right now? What spaces are you into? How are you finding? I mean, Benchmark's a unique firm in that it's super well known. It's one of the top tier firms. People come to you, I'm sure, all the time. But how are you sourcing? What are you looking at? How do you think about that?
You know, in 2018, I spent a lot of time in crypto. And, you know, as you know, like the process for us to find opportunities is always about just diving into a space and speaking to people, reading, reaching out. I mean, the first investment I made here at Benchmark is a company called Chainalysis. And that was basically a cold email from me to the founder. Yeah. And so like, you know, you have to do all that type of work. I kind of think about it as an air game and a ground game. You know, the air game is doing things like this podcast, blogging, going to conferences. And then the ground game is the day to day, you know, pounding the pavement that you end up doing to try to find opportunities. This year, like as I reflected on the things that I think are really starting to bubble up, like I'm redoubling my focus on consumer, and starting to really.
But consumer's dead, I thought.
I know, that's, you know, and what I realize is like, we've just atrophied in our attention to consumer, but like the need that people have to belong and feel that sense of connection, like that's universal. And I think that a lot of the online spaces that we have are decaying for that need. And so I really believe that we're going to start to see some unbundling of the existing social spaces. And so I'm trying to figure that out and go deep.
Rockmelt had a unique take on social as it related to the browser. What is your perspective of kind of consumer and social today, Eric?
I think that every time we think something's dead, something new is reborn. And so it's just a really bad frame of mind to think that a space is dead or that there wouldn't be something happening there or that something new couldn't emerge. It's just as soon as you think that, like something, I remember I had this exchange in 2008 about, or maybe 2007 or 2008 when we were working on coming up with an idea for Rockmelt. And I had this exchange with Mark Andreessen, and I was, and one of the things I said was like, you know, a lot of the infrastructure stuff, like databases and stuff is just, there's nothing there. And, you know, he replied back and was like, really? Like, really? Is there not going to be any more database innovation forever? Like, is that really what you believe? And of course, like right then and subsequently, there have been like a dozen new databases, many of which we at Benchmark have invested in, including Elastic, MySQL got bought, which is a Benchmark company, CockroachDB, Kafka. Like you have Timescale. Like, I mean, literally we have five or six database companies that we are working with that are doing really, really interesting things and are breaking out. And I think, so I feel the same way about consumer now. I think it was a good lesson in that as soon as you think it's over, it'll probably come from an unexpected place. It won't be a direct competitor to Facebook. It won't be Facebook reborn. Like there's just that isn't the way it's going to happen. It will be something unexpected, orthogonal, that comes out of nowhere, but that meets this need for people to connect. And I think that it'll happen. I don't know where. I don't know how. And there are lots of examples of that even in our own investing.
Are you looking at particular, I guess, platform shifts in consumer? Or is it audio voice? Is it crypto as it relates to consumer? Is it, you know, what areas kind of within consumer do you think are exciting?
You know, that actually is why why I think it's such an interesting time to be looking at consumers, because there are so many different angles that, you know, people are exploring. I mean, there's definitely stuff happening in audio, you know, just the premise of not just having Alexa devices everywhere, but people having AirPods in their ears and being increasingly connected to an audio input device all the time. Like, there's something to that. You can't help but see the evolution of people spending time in third spaces like Minecraft, then that going to Roblox, and then now, you know, things like Fortnite and other gaming platforms. And it's just, you know, I kind of think about the existing social platforms as these more passive, like very read heavy, some write, you can think of it. And now we're going to these experiences where there's a lot of interaction actually happening. And that's much more of a conduit for connection than I think we've had. And so I'm just, you know, exploring that. Like, you even think about, it's like we have so many horizontal platforms, and the horizontal platforms, like when you create a horizontal platform, you have to have a lowest common denominator, because you don't want to create too much complexity by solving for any one use case. But that ends up meaning that it's not the ideal space for different collections of people. I mean, you think about the diversity of conversations that happen on Reddit or Discord as an example. And so it does feel to me like there should start to be some, you know, atomizing almost of these experiences, where you can go deeper and deeper and have an identity that's specific to that type of use case. And so starting to see some things bubble up, you definitely see that happening when influencers on YouTube creating their own communities with what happened with gaming and Discord. And so I'm exploring, you know, I'm on a Facebook group for moms, and I've never seen a more intense group. And it just feels like the type of experience, like the searches you want to do, the structured content that you want to relate to, it's just not what Facebook groups can solve for. And so why aren't more of these communities starting to break off? I wonder if that, especially for young people, I just wonder if that's going to happen.
I wonder, just listening to you talk about it, and I think this is a really important part of even how we approach investing and the kind of stuff we look at. You know, first off, it's just like maybe the first wave was really getting people connected in the first place. Like, and since the origins or since the founding of the platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you know, in the 10 subsequent years, you have what, 1.5 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion more people in the world connected, period, like online. And now that that has happened, you can actually get subgroups because there's enough scale for that to make sense. I mean, this is a weird analogy, but the same thing is kind of true, frankly, of the database example I was going through before, because now there's like literally so much digital data that whereas you used to have one Oracle, use case specific stuff didn't make sense because there wasn't the scale of problem. Now that you have so much digital data and so many digital applications and different ways to use that data, the use case specific databases all of a sudden start to make a lot more sense for big enough use cases.
It's also what seems to be happening in the crypto ecosystem, where you had this general platform, which was Ethereum, trying to be this world computer and trying to be everything for everyone. And it, you know, that's kind of the first generation of computing platform in a new area. But then what you're starting to see, and what I think will happen more and more, is that instead of applications trying to build on Ethereum, they may start rolling their own blockchain or taking another open source project and tuning it tighter to their own use case. Because that's what happens once, you know, it's that expression, there's two ways to make money, bundling and unbundling. And as we specialize, you have the unbundling. And it seems like we're on the cusp of that wave happening in a bunch of different areas.
Yeah, it's kind of, if you look at terrestrial TV as a kind of a proxy to some extent, you know, before when TV was introduced, there were only a few channels and that was all you got. And it was kind of the lowest common denominator. And now we have cable, you know, came to rise. Now we have hundreds of channels. Now we have the internet, which leads to YouTube and Netflix and all these others. Now we have so much content that if you're name any kind of demographic or persona, you could probably find some TV show or movie that's like catered to that audience.
Without question.
And I feel like maybe we're in the same with communities.
And dozens of influencers specific to that topic.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe we're sort of in the cable phase, which will lead to the Netflix, YouTube phase of communities and people to congregate. You know, I actually have a blog post about maker communities, specifically like the communities that are in support of makers across different domains, whether it's design or engineering or just general purpose or vertically, like demographically focused communities, like, Tech Ladies is one example where it's like women focused in tech. And it's just interesting to look back over the past three or four years, most of those on my list of maker communities didn't exist actually. Yeah.
You know, it's like we talked about belonging before. Like there, one of the things we talked about is, you know, if you're like a kid growing up in a town or a neighborhood, it used to be that your local maxima was the population with which you lived. And so if you were the best basketball player in your junior high, then you were the best basketball player. As far as you knew, you were the best basketball player. And then what happened was that the internet created a view into the global maxima where suddenly you could see some kid on YouTube who's, you know, 2 feet taller than you and 2 years younger than you, who's doing a dunk shot that you know you can never do. And suddenly you realize like you are not the best kid around. And that has been a lot of the last wave of the internet. Like what's that created is this view into the global maxima. And now there's been this pullback from that and the desire, I think, to create a lot of these different communities.
What are your thoughts around geography and how it seems like there's more and more interesting companies outside of, you know, traditional tech hubs? And as it kind of relates to that too, it's also easier to build things. So it feels like to get something off the ground, you don't necessarily need to be in these hubs. What trends are you seeing? Or are you talking to companies outside of the Bay and so on?
We're talking to companies outside of the Bay Area all the time, actually. And I think the volume of them has increased a lot. I think the reality is and this is a really, really positive development from my perspective, with open source, with SaaS, with the cloud, with persistent connectivity or global connectivity, people with good ideas almost anywhere can start projects, get momentum, get ideas, and get going. And Benchmark has had success. If you look back, Zendesk was started in Europe. Elastic was started in Europe. We have current investments, Contentful, ResearchGate, others that were started in Europe and got some traction, got some early traction, built the initial product, but were serving US customers and US users almost from the beginning. And we were able to work with them. And in a lot of cases now, I think the thing that hasn't happened yet in most of these cases is go to market. Sales and marketing has been built stateside and often in the Bay Area. And there's no reason that has to be the case, but that has been the case. And a lot of the customers are here. So that's been the case. A lot of the expertise in scaling go to market is here, not even in the US, but it's actually in the Bay Area, like even New York hasn't had that many examples of go-to-market being scaled for tech companies in New York.
Yeah. When I meet a company that's outside the Valley, I would get on a soapbox and talk about how they have to be here if they want to scale. And I always kind of thought that, you know, from zero to a couple hundred million market cap, you can build that anywhere. But to be that multi-billion-dollar company, you have to be here. I still believe that, but not as strongly as I used to. And it's because you do see so many examples of companies that are getting started and are getting to some scale outside of the Valley. And it's, you know, part of it also is that the Valley has just become, as you guys well know, like it's so expensive. It's hard to find housing. I mean, there's some really endemic problems that we're facing. And so there's a lot of reason to get started outside the Valley. And even for the companies that are based here, what's interesting is that the advice we give those companies oftentimes is to very quickly establish another office outside of the Valley. You can grow a team of engineers because you have to diversify in a way when you're here. At the same time, like, there's no better place to find talent that has gone through hypergrowth, that has scaled these big companies. And when you're going through hypergrowth, it's really freaking hard. And it's great to have someone around the table who has been there before. So I think you can't undervalue that, but it is pretty shocking the number of deals that we are very seriously considering, if not doing, that are actually outside of Silicon Valley right now.
You were at Pinterest. You joined when there were a couple dozen, right? Mm-hmm. And then you left probably, how many people were there?
It was 650.
600. That's insane.
I have some gray hairs from it.
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of people have not experienced that or gone through that kind of growth.
Yeah, no, that's right. And like, I remember early days at Pinterest, you know, most companies that go through hypergrowth aren't always up and to the right. And there were times where there were moments where we got through it in a way because there were people around the table who had already experienced those types of moments. And they knew how to pull forward the future into the present by like knowing what are the things that we're going to face once we reach a certain level of scale, and let's start planning for that or setting the foundation now. And you can't do that unless you've experienced it. So just having those people around the table just help you set your company up for success as it continues to grow.
Yeah.
I think the global talent pool, we should be able to take advantage of the global talent pool. It makes sense, right? And the way that that's happened historically is global talent has relocated. And now you are in a world where global talent doesn't have to relocate. I will say there is one advantage that we observe of companies based in the Bay Area because it's expensive and because it's challenging, because it's hard, is they actually get better at prioritization. And so if you look at companies outside of the Bay Area where talent is cheaper and you can actually hire more people and scale, is they don't have to make as many hard, well, we should do this and we shouldn't do this. And it's been a really interesting thing that I've observed over the last 6 months or so of companies outside the Bay Area that we see that get to 5 million in ARR or 6 million or 10 million or 2 million. And so they've gotten somewhere. They've made some progress. It certainly isn't the end all be all of what any one of these entrepreneurs aspire to be. And one of the things that's interesting, if you just look at the financial metrics, it actually looks pretty interesting. It looks pretty good and pretty efficient. If you look at the ARR per headcount or revenue per headcount or dollars per headcount, it's actually not that efficient. And so what's interesting to me as these companies have grown is, so they have less dollars per headcount. They have more heads because they can have more heads, and it costs them less because it costs twice as much here. And so what's really interesting is they don't pay the penalty for that until they reach certain scale. Once you get to 150 people or 200 people, the communication overhead of all those people really can grind your product development to halt, can grind your go-to-market development, can grind your experimentation, can really create a lot of management overhead. And so one of the interesting things that is kind of a byproduct of the remote work or the kind of development out of here, outside of the Bay Area, is a need to learn the prioritization muscle. I think here it's forced just because of the constraints, and in some ways outside of the Bay Area it isn't. But overall, it just seems like a very positive development.
Yeah, it's funny how the capital constraint doesn't seem to be something that's limiting anywhere, but people constraint is real. And that does make every hire that you make harder and more important when you're here. And there is something that's an interesting constraint on the market.
Yeah, it always feels, I've had different conversations with teammates where we have a million ideas that we want to pursue. And it always feels like we're understaffed, that we don't have enough people. And I always...
Never change. Google will say the same thing. Like, you know, with 85,000 people or however many they have, they would say the same thing. Facebook, 25,000 would say the same thing. You always have that. And I would just say, like, that's good.
Yeah.
When it's working, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, but it is good. If you're like, well, we have enough people, we don't have any more ideas. I think we build everything that we need to build. You're right. It should always feel that way, and that can be part of the frustration. Going back to the patience thing too, as a founder, you're super impatient. I'm super impatient every day because it's just the nature of like building. You want the idea that you're coming up with to be built and live today, but you know it doesn't work that way. What products do you love? Let's switch gears a little bit. Like what's on your home screen? What's something you bought recently?
Let's take out the
Sarah's
old phone.
a new parent.
Oh yeah, I'm a new parent. Well, one of the things Eric and I have as a shared, and it's not just the two of us, the Benchmark Partnership, we're big podcast listeners, and one of the apps that probably most of us have on our home screen is Breaker. Do you use those guys?
Yeah.
Just, oh, yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, podcast consumption, finding things, it being, being able to discover podcasts through other people. That's always something I spend a lot of time. I mean, inevitably on, you know, with, as a new parent, on Instagram, my son has his own profile, which is, I feel like a rite of passage.
Well, I've noticed this. There's, at least within the tech world, you know, the first thing, not the first thing, but a lot of parents are creating accounts, whether it's Twitter account or Instagram account, to document and share kind of what's happening in their baby's lives. And I find it kind of interesting because imagine, you know, being that kid.
I think about that all the time. Yeah.
And when they turn 8 or whatever age you want to like give them the keys, then they're like, I already have a Twitter account with all this stuff.
Yep.
It's kind of interesting.
I mean, it's part of the reason why, like, you've just got to. I'm sure people will just create, like the Instagram account we have for him is under his name. And I wonder whether I should just change it and make it a different name so that, you know, like a Finsta for him. Yeah. And then he'll get to have his own if Instagram is still the default, which I'd be shocked if it was.
Yeah. In 8 years.
In 8 years. Yeah.
A decade.
There's just so many utilities that I use right now on my phone. Like I'm really into quantifying things for myself. And so I have, you know, HeartWatch and AutoSleep to help me understand how I'm sleeping, what I can be doing better to improve my sleep. I try to meditate. I've been doing TM recently. And so I have a tool I use every day to time my meditations. I have been spending a lot of time on Twitch lately. You know, I have to improve my Fortnite game.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you grow up playing video games?
I played, well, you're making me feel old. When I started playing video games, I mean, like the first video game I played was King's Quest on like an Apple IIgs. Like there was no idea of like being able to play together. I remember World of Warcraft coming out when I was in college. And I played that like, but you know, it was never a big part of my life. I mean, SimCity, I'll admit I spent a lot of time, but again, that was, not even first generation, but it was very different than the types of things happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's changed so much.
Are you a gamer?
I grew up gaming a lot. My parents owned a video game store, so
it you're kidding.
Part of my childhood, and I played PC games, console games. Yeah, I love playing games. I don't really play anymore though. And it's a common theme, I think, once people get to adulthood and get a job, I think a lot of people kind of churn out, but I still admire and love it. I love video games. It's like, culturally from, I think there's a lot to learn from gaming. First two startups I joined were in gaming. And I think a lot of friends of mine who started gaming companies now moved on to other things. They take a lot of learnings of like human psychology and game mechanics and apply it to whether it's B2B or B2C. I think there's a lot you can learn from the gaming industry, both as investor and operator.
People who have worked on games and dating as product leaders, you learn so much.
They're kind of the same thing.
They're very similar, very, very similar. And like, and even, you know, just you become experts even in the mechanics of monetization and like so much the human psychology of it. Like I remember talking to one PM from Match.com and he talked about just even the changes of talking about a monthly subscription to the cost of the subscription based on a day. And just, you know, those little things that make it easier for a person to say yes. Like it really is amazing what you learn.
I use a lot of the standard apps that I think everyone uses. I think the things that are interesting for me, Nextdoor seems to have really, which is a portfolio company, seems to have, like, I see the traction and that really like breaking out. I'm actually impressed with the Marco Polo usage among my family in terms of just like the little videos back and forth that are not appropriate for iMessage, but just like keep kind of an ongoing pseudo-synchronous dialogue with people. Video dialogue with people is very interesting. Sarah and I have a lot of fun with Bitmoji.
I love the Bitmoji.
You can say almost everything you need to say on text through Bitmoji, which is just much more fun and useful.
I think Bitmoji is one of the most underrated.
So amazing.
Products and also trends. I think I've been.
And acquisitions.
And acquisitions,
Well, 100 million.
Was that the price?
I think around that.
Something around there. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the founder, CEO is still there.
Yeah. I don't know actually the answer to that, but it's, I mean, anytime you look at the top 10 apps on iOS, and I imagine Android, it's always up there. Yeah. I think about that as mobile first communication. You know, it's just like this way, you know, as we've reduced the density of our communication from the in-person experience to mobile to that, I mean, to like voice, where you still get a lot of density in that communication, you know, emotion, everything else, to then you go to text message. It's such a stripped down version. And then you add a Bitmoji or GIFs. We know we don't see a lot of animated GIFs anymore, but like that's similar. But there's something that's so personal about Bitmoji that's just so brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Can I make a request for a product to the Product Hunt community?
Yeah, if someone builds this, please.
The new iOS 12 stock app has been designed and built by people who don't look at stocks. That part is very clear. Like it's literally the worst possible design you could imagine. I think the initial iOS 1 stock app was better than this one. It is so atrocious.
Someone please build this so I don't have to hear Eric complain about this every other day.
Literally, it's so bad. And there has to be a better stock app, and I cannot find one. I was actually, it's one of these things, I was talking to one of our partners, Bill, about this, who also looks at stocks a lot, and it's the kind of thing that Robinhood might actually end up being able to do in a really good way. But that would be one that like somebody should do, and it's a very monetizable community. There's something to be built. So between like Yahoo Finance going down the toilet and this iOS app, it's very frustrating.
What are the three features or things? Like let's build a spec on the podcast. are there three features or things that you feel like a stock app should do, or what do you think is missing?
Well, I think the big thing is you need to be able to uncover layers of data. So like you start with your watch list, everyone has a watch list, then you need to be able to get to some more data and you need to understand the actual things that are happening around that company. And then you need to be able to get to more and deeper financial data. There's an app that we use that a few of us use called Scout, which was actually pretty interesting. But I think something along those lines where you can, it's like, it's almost progressive disclosure in terms of like understanding things. But it's a really interesting and gaping hole that has been left by folks like Yahoo and Apple just completely shitting the bed.
I think there's, I don't look at stocks, but what is interesting to me is data and numbers is always really compelling. And if you could tell a story with data and numbers, maybe the stock app is actually more, it's a combination of stock tracking, but it's also like storytelling. And if it's telling the story of why does Tesla just drop 6%, and here's maybe some insights about that or something, I don't know. Maybe there's an app out there that does something like that, but that's where my mind goes into, where I'd be like, oh, I'd actually maybe use that. And I don't normally look at stocks. Cool. Thanks for coming on. Where can they find you? Anything to plug? Any portfolio companies you want to
promote? Yes.
Plug time. Time to plug.
You can find both of us on Twitter, and my email address is just my first name at Benchmark. And portfolio to plug, we don't have much of a website.
I know your portfolio is a Twitter list.
Yes. And so it is a Twitter list. If people are ever curious what else is in the portfolio, in my personal portfolio, if anybody, you know, especially with the government shutdown and people are wanting to go camping and they can't because their national parks are closed, unfortunately, you should check out a company called Hip Camp, which is an incredible place to find land to camp on. Really beautiful settings, both with structures, or if you're a hardcore camper, just a tent. You know, Eric did a good job of mentioning Marco Polo. I love that product too. If you kind of gives you this ability to do asynchronous video messages with the people that you're connected to.
Where can they find you, Eric?
On Twitter. On Twitter, same email, first name at benchmark.com. I think I got my plugs in.
Got your plugs in. Cool. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's so great to see you.
Yeah, good seeing you. Take care.
Bye.
Take care. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.